This lecture is on the entrepreneur and profit. And we want to start off by pointing out that every action that a human being takes is oriented towards the future. Okay? It's intended to improve that individual's welfare or satisfaction as he or she perceives it at some point in the future. So if you go into a restaurant and you're making a choice from a menu, okay, that action may take a few minutes. On the other hand, if you're involved in producing a new product, innovating a new software program, that might take a few years. In any case, all action is embedded in what we call the flux of, what Mises called the flux of time. It begins in the present and ends at some point in the future. Okay? It could be the more remote future or it could be the very near future. Now, that means because time lapsed, there's a lapse of time between the beginning of the action and the final product of the action, that you bear uncertainty. So everyone, once they become aware, okay, as they grow from an infant, and they become aware and they begin to have desires and understand they themselves can satisfy those desires by acting, they all become entrepreneurs in a very broad sense. Okay, so as we'll see, Austrian economics uses the term entrepreneur in two senses. In one sense, in a very broad sense, we are all entrepreneurs. Okay. For example, your attendance here at the Mises University was based on certain expectations of what you would learn, how stimulating or boring the speakers would be. And so you made a choice and decided that the benefit from the attendance here outweighed any of the costs, that is, any other option of your time, okay, or for your time this week. Okay, so you could have had the chance to continue to work and, let's say, earn $400. Or you could have gone camping with friends. Okay, you had whatever was the next highest value, okay, or the next highest ranked end on your value scale is the cost. Okay, so what you did then was you compared, okay, so this is Mises University, $400. Okay, not the money you spent necessarily, though that's part of your cost, but the money you gave up maybe in not working. And let me just put this on here. Going camping, etc. Okay, the cost is always the second ranked end that is foregone. Okay, so the cost is the opportunity to work for $400. We call that an opportunity cost. That term has already been introduced here. So what you did was you compared the benefit to the cost, and we use a fancy term here. Before the action is undertaken, we say that that's ex ante. In Latin, that means from the standpoint of before the action. Benefit exceeded cost. Now, you could have come here and been bored to tears by the whole thing, and you could have regretted it. Okay? Just as you can regret a choice on a menu at a restaurant. You could have gotten a certain beef dish, and it turns out not to be very good, and you could have given up what you would have chosen next, some fish. Okay, that is continually happening. If that happens, that simply means you were a bad entrepreneur. The benefit turned out to be lower than the cost. You should have stayed at home and earned $400. If you're happy with your choice, you don't regret it, then you've earned a profit. So we call these regrets, or the fact that you're happy or you're successful in making the choice, we call that psychic profit and psychic loss. When you're happy with something you've done, that's a psychic profit. So profit has roots in the very actions of individuals. It's not just a business concept. So psychic profit simply means that what you got in your action, the satisfaction, exceeded the satisfaction that you gave up. Psychic loss, we can use, implies the opposite, that you wasted your scarce time. Okay, not to mention your energy and your and possibly monetary funds that you spent to get here and to return home. Okay, so a psychic loss implies that the benefit, what you got, was less than the cost, what you gave up. Right, and again, it doesn't have to be money. It could have been camping. Could have been second on your list. Okay, so every day you act as entrepreneurs, because all action involves uncertainty. And we'll come back to why that should be so in more, a little more detail. As Mises says, every action has an entrepreneurial element in it. Okay? The individual is doing what? The individual is anticipating the future, okay, and what state of the future that he or she can control will make them most happy, and then adjusting their actions to it. Now, we all have friends that continually make errors in their everyday lives, right? You know people that continually regret choices. They go to one college and then transfer after the first semester to another college and might transfer once again. Or they choose one major and get locked into taking certain courses and then have to stay an extra year in college because they don't like that major. So that's continually happening. Now, some people are better at everyday entrepreneurship than other people. That is, they're better at forecasting what their values will be in the future, what their opportunities will be in the future, and so on, and adjusting their actions to that. Others are worse. The key is that the people that are consistently better are generally the ones then that go on to become business entrepreneurs. Okay? And Mises used the term, we can talk about business entrepreneurs as opposed to everyday entrepreneurs. He called them promoter entrepreneurs. That is, they promote new ideas, new organizations, new products, and so on. The word entrepreneur, by the way, is a French term. It means entrepreneur. Actually, in English, in the 19th century, it used to be translated as enterpriser, okay, or undertaker. You've seen a lot of old American textbooks, in particular, in the U.S., the term undertaker being used in the late 19th century, possibly early 20th century. But by the early 20th century, that dropped out because that came to denote a mortician. Okay, so we no longer use that term. An enterpriser was sort of a clunky term. So entrepreneur, the French term, then was anglicized, and it became the term that we use in economics. All right, now let's move on a little to the entrepreneur, the promoter entrepreneur. Okay, what does this narrower concept apply to? Well, it applies to those people, okay, who are eager to profit from change. In other words, they are the ones that know there's continual change in the world, and that as a result, certain things are not being done that would best serve consumers. That certain resources are being used in lower values than they could be used in. So if you can buy those resources at the lower price that has been placed on it at this point in time, and then shift them into a new use, okay, or into a new technology to produce the same product but at a lower cost, you can earn profits. Right? So the promoter entrepreneur refers to that person who is relatively good at anticipating the changing future, what consumer demands will be in the future, what the available resources will be in the future, what technology will be in the future, okay, and then adjusting production to take advantage of that. And it always is based on a perceived discrepancy in prices, the prices of what you can get your inputs at and the prices at which you can sell the output at. Now, this is, again, as Mises pointed out, based on a datum of human action. That is, we know, okay, even in our private lives, our daily lives, that some people are better at avoiding mistakes in their actions, at undertaking actions that make them better off. Okay? Other people are worse at it and continually regret actions. So the business or promoter entrepreneur is generally the group of people that are really the best at this type of activity, though they themselves can make mistakes. Okay, we're going to point that out. Okay. So, in other words, an entrepreneur is not someone, is not a factor of production, is not a resource. He's not someone that works. Okay, that he does work, as we'll see, but the specific function of entrepreneurship, okay, is that of an intellectual decision about how to use resources. So what we call a specific function of the entrepreneur is to determine the employment of the factors of production, to determine how to use resources, how much, what to produce, how much to produce, what technology to use, where to produce, all of those decisions are the entrepreneurs. So we call the entrepreneur the ultimate decision maker. Okay, Bill Gates is the ultimate decision maker, or was, for Microsoft. Ray Kroc, the milkshake machine salesman that started the McDonald's chain back in 1954, was in control of that corporation, was the ultimate decision maker. Okay. Generally, these people have knowledge of the industry in which they become a promoter entrepreneur. So Ray Kroc sold to a lot of restaurants, soda shops, okay, and so on throughout the Midwest, okay, and in California. He also sold paper products to restaurants. And his idea was taken from the automobiles, believe it or not. He said, you know what? Just like automobiles can be assembled, so can hamburgers. In other words, you don't have to have one person doing everything. Okay, that was the basic idea. Okay, in the fast food, his innovation in bringing about fast food. Also, he saw, which other people did not necessarily see, was that America was becoming more suburbanized after World War II. Cars were spreading all over. People were moving out of the cities. So Americans had longer commutes. They had less time to eat and so on. And he saw that as one of the factors that would lead to fast food being profitable. Because before McDonald's, there wasn't really any fast food. Now, the other point, of course, he also saw that, and he notes this in some of his writings, Ray Kroc, that people want consistency. It doesn't have to be the best hamburger, but when people travel around the country, okay, they never know what they're getting. Well, they never used to know what they were getting when they went into a diner or a restaurant, okay? But now with the McDonald's name branded on it, and with him overseeing the process and making sure that the process was uniform through all the franchises, okay, and controlling some of the supplies to those franchises, he recognized then that he would better serve consumers. He would give them confidence in what they were getting. Okay. Again, it wasn't the best food, but it was something that was always of a certain quality, okay, that could be depended upon. Okay. What else does the entrepreneur do? Okay, as I said, the entrepreneur has to be able to more or less forecast future market conditions. He has to know what the supplies and demands will be in the future. And then bring that back to the present and decide what prices he'll have to pay to make it profitable for the inputs. Okay. So let's assume that someone knows that Americans have become more diet conscious. Right? And you are, let's say you're a beer company. It's the middle of the 1970s and Americans are more diet conscious. Well, one thing you might do is you might try to introduce a niche beer called Light, okay? Which is what Miller Lite did, which is what the Miller Brewing Company did, okay? They heavily advertised and they brought about they brought to market a beer. Now, that beer hadn't existed before. They had to figure out what price people were willing to pay for that beer, if it would more than cover their costs and give them a profit, okay? And they were very successful, and after that, then many light beers were introduced into the market, okay? The same thing with the personal computer. I mentioned this already. Steve Jobs, one of the founders of Apple, had to decide if business would take to the personal computer, if it would be widely used in business and begin to transplant mainframes. He had to have confidence in that vision of the future. That's a big leap. And if so, what price he could get for that personal computer, okay, or for the Apple in this case. What are some of the other qualities of a good entrepreneur or of the entrepreneur? He must also be an owner of capital. He must have some capital of his own, okay, to put this idea into play. So he also has to be an owner. Now, that's not specifically an entrepreneurial function, okay? He must be able to oversee his operations. And as we'll see, he can hire managers for that, but then he has to make sure that the managers he hires share his vision and are able to translate what he sees as the future of the company into the real world. Now, Ray Kroc hired a hamburger flipper who was fascinated by the making of hamburgers. Okay, just kind of like a nerd hamburger flipper, to be one of his major executives and gave him a lot of stock. He also hired a woman who was a very loyal secretary and so on to work in the headquarters. They became millionaires because he paid them in stock. Okay, they trusted him. Okay. Also, here's something very important. The entrepreneur is the sole bearer of risk. Okay. And let me give you an illustration of what I mean by that. He pays all of the inputs, all of the resources, all the labor, okay, all of the capital that he has to rent or buy, pays for that in advance of the sale of the product on the market. Now, when GM lost $10 billion last year, did the workers lose one penny? No. They were paid every 2 weeks. They didn't lose anything. They were paid in advance. Who suffered that loss? The entrepreneurs, the shareholders in this case, many of whom are the managers who, the upper level management, okay, they suffer that loss. Okay, and the same is true in any business. Because production takes time, the inputs get paid in advance. Now, workers can lose their jobs, but they haven't suffered any losses or any part of the losses from the incorrect decisions that were made. Right? The cars, sell for a price lower than their cost of production, so they cut back on those cars. The workers may be fired, okay, but that just affects their future income. They don't lose any of their capital. That's why we say that the entrepreneur is a residual claimant. He gets what's left over, whether it's positive or negative. Okay, so he gets the residue. Now, here's where managers come in. Things are continually changing, okay, in the real world. And also, if the firm is very big, the entrepreneur cannot be everywhere. Okay, the owner entrepreneur cannot be everywhere. So he has to hire people to aid him or assist him in overseeing his operations, okay, and also making those small changes that they see in their various departments will improve the profits of the firm. Some people confuse the managers as the decision makers. Okay, but managers are not decision makers. We might call them junior partners of the entrepreneur. What allows the entrepreneur to run huge firms, Bill Gates to run Microsoft, is the fact that we have double entry bookkeeping. That is, we have an accounting system which allows us or allows the entrepreneur to monitor how each department is doing, okay, how each small department, each division is doing, okay. That is, to allocate costs to that division and the revenues generated by that division. He can see that. So he can see how well they're doing. Now, managers do get paid on the basis of how well their divisions are doing. They get bonuses. They get stock options. Okay, but they are not the entrepreneurs. Now, why aren't they the entrepreneurs? What's the worst thing that can happen to a manager if his division performs very poorly? Fired. Has he lost any capital? No, unless he owns some stock, in which case he is acting as a capitalist. But let's assume he doesn't. He's just getting bonuses. He might not get bonuses or he could get fired. Okay? So the key point is that managers are not the ultimate decision makers because they cannot suffer losses. Though they do share in the profits through bonuses and so on that they help generate. Okay. So as I said, there are all these profit centers and the entrepreneur can monitor his firm. Now some economists, one famous economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, was a very famous left-wing economist who wrote voluminously from the 50s through until he died, I think in the late 90s, no, actually a few years ago, okay. He claimed that, well, you know what, in modern industry, where we have the corporate firm, ownership and control is separated. Actually, that claim was made in the 1930s by two other people, Burley and Means. And Galbraith was very influenced by them. One was a New Deal lawyer. The other was sort of a left-wing economist. And that stockholders are just going about their business. They're small stockholders. They don't exercise daily control of the firm. The managers do. So Galbraith went on, the managers run the firm in their own interests. Yes, they want stock prices to go up, and they want and in order to do that, they have to earn some profits. But they're more interested in raising their own salaries, in raising their own, in getting more and more perquisites. They want company jets, right, at their disposal. They want a chauffeur who will not only take them to work, but will chauffeur their children back and forth to school. They want expensive country club memberships. They would rather hire three very pretty secretaries, assuming it's a male CEO, instead of one very efficient secretary. Now, that all does what? That all raises costs. Okay. So Galbraith's claim that there's something called a technocracy. The scientific personnel or the technical personnel plus the managers that control the firm. It was this group that controlled the firm, not the owner entrepreneurs. Okay. And this is before really Bill Gates and the high-tech revolution, when we saw that individual entrepreneurs were again very, very important. Okay. They were starting to lose their importance in the U.S. in the 1950s and 1960s when unions began to get very, very big and powerful and to prevent change, okay, in the steel companies and automobile companies, both of which industries are still suffering, of course, from that. They're not dynamic at all. Now, what do economists, how do we respond to Galbraith? Well, we respond by pointing out that there's a number of ways to get rid of managers who are running the firm in their own interests. Now, I don't know if Peter Klein talked about this, Dr. Klein, but you know, it's called the principal agent problem. How do you get your agent, person you're hiring to perform a certain function for you, to do your bidding, to act in your interests and not in his own interests? Okay. Are there any mechanisms in place to ensure that the control of the corporate firm is in the hands of the owners? Well, let me give you an example that Murray Rothbard used to give, just as an illustration. Let's say you're some big multimillionaire. Let's say John D. Rockefeller, okay? And let's say Rockefeller has a huge estate, okay, up in upstate New York that he goes to maybe once or twice a month, okay? And he has hired a very skilled, let's say, landscaper to landscape the estate, pays him a lot of money. Well, if you're an observer, if you live in the neighborhood, who do you see making all the decisions about what to plant on that estate? The landscaper, okay, the head landscaper. He's completely in charge. Well, what if Rockefeller comes up one day and just does not like the layout of the estate? Okay, what does he do? He says, you're fired. Okay? So managers can be fired. There's a number of ways that can occur. There can be board of directors are paid to represent stockholders' interests. They don't always do that, okay? But there are incentives which will induce them to do that. And so the board of directors can throw out the management, okay, if they think the management team is not acting in the interests of the stockholders. Even more than that, if you think the board of directors isn't acting in your interest, there are things called proxy fights, where there are a number of large shareholders who are risking millions and millions of dollars in the firm. They have the incentive to oversee, to look more closely into what's going on in that firm. You or I, who might have 50 shares or 100 shares worth a few thousand dollars, we might not have the time or want to expend the resources into looking into what's going on. Small stockholders may not, okay? So the large stockholders get together, get a new team, a new board of directors that they would like to have elected, and there's a proxy fight, and the old board can be thrown out. And when the old board is thrown out, then the new board comes in and they can fire the managers and put in better managers. Okay? But really most importantly, and this is where small stockholders come in, is really what's called the market for corporate control. If small stockholders feel that they're not getting a good return on their money, what do? They sell their stock. And that pushes the stock down, the value of the stock down. So if, outstanding stock of a company is worth $10 billion, and suddenly people note that the company is not performing well, okay, they're not happy with their dividends and the other policies, the way the stock is moving, they can begin to sell. And as they sell, let's say that falls to $7.5 billion. Okay, the total outstanding value of the stock. Well, then some other entrepreneur in the same industry or some of these buyout firms will simply say, I'll buy this out at $7.5 billion, and I believe the assets that they have in this firm, if they're used correctly, will be worth $11 billion. So they begin to buy the stock. They bid up the price. Maybe they bid the price up to $8.5 billion, that is the total. But they buy it out, and they still have a huge profit of billions of dollars. Okay? So hostile takeovers, which was the word that was used in the 1980s, it was a negative term. There were movies like Wall Street, that were attacking people that went in and bought out firms and threw out the managers. Okay. But they were representing the interests of the stockholders. Okay, because the stockholders were getting more in the buyout than they would have gotten, okay, if they just sold it individually. And the firm's assets, from the point of view of consumers, were being used in a better way. If the value of the stock goes up, that means that that reflects is the fact that the goods, the capital goods the firm owns, are now being used to produce more valued output for consumers. So consumers benefit, stockholders benefit from these so-called hostile takeovers. Okay, they're actually working for us as consumers, and they're working for the stockholders. During that period, you saw a lot of letters in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And they would say, you know, this is terrible. This pressure to keep the price of stock up is causing American management to take a very short-run view. Unlike the Japanese firms, which can take a long-run view, don't have to earn profit right away, but also of this other nonsense. Okay, of course, in order to get your stock price up, okay, stock prices aren't based on current income. What are they based on? Projected income. So of course you're taking the long run view, okay? Who signed? Who do you think signed those letters and sent them to the Wall Street Journal? Well, not really the employees, the managers of the firms that were targets of hostile takeovers. So you got all these ridiculous Hollywood movies, as I mentioned, somehow bashing these takeover artists. Though there was one good movie with Danny DeVito in it called Other People's Money, which is pro-hostile takeover. Okay? So I want to take a look at that. Okay, so there is a mechanism there. Now, let's talk about the entrepreneur's income. Okay? Not his income as the owner of capital goods, but his pure profit income. And let me take a very simple example. First of all, if any of you have had accounting, the accounting definition of profit is wrong. Okay? Not wrong for the business uses, it's wrong from the point of view of the economist. This symbol is the Greek symbol pi. We use that because in economics we use P to represent price. Okay? This is total revenue, okay, generated by the firm. Total revenue equals the price per unit of the good sold times the quantity of the good sold. Total cost is the total wages, rents, and so on, expended on inputs and resources. So let's say you have a small landscaping business, and let's say the total out-of-pocket costs to this landscaping business is $100,000. Okay, that's the cost of the shrubbery, that's the wages that you're paying. Okay, we'll take the accounting costs first. These are the accounting costs, the out-of-pocket costs. We'll forget about depreciation. And let's say this firm earns in a year $120,000. Well, the accountant would say, well, the net earnings of the firm is $20,000. Okay. And let's assume this is a single proprietorship. It's owned by one individual. But the economists would want to know a lot more. Okay, you say, wait a minute. Okay. Did this individual manage the firm? If the individual managed the firm, then you have to take into account the fact that he could have worked elsewhere, right, as a manager of another small firm. And that means that you have to take into account what we call his foregone wages. Okay. So he could have acted. So we have foregone managerial wages or manager's wages. And let's say he could have earned $50,000. Well, that has to be in the accounts. That has to be taken account of. That has to be taken account of, that $50,000 that he gives up to manage his own firm. Also, let's say he has his own truck that he uses, his own dump truck. And he could have rented it out for $5,000 a year. He could have leased it out to another company. $5,000. That's a foregone rent. Okay? So all these things are foregone. And finally, let's assume he didn't borrow the money from a bank, so there's no out-of-pocket interest payments and principal payments. He took that $100,000 that he invested out of his own savings. Okay? But yet, there's still a foregone interest rate, right? You have to have an interest rate there. He gave up the opportunity of investing that, let's say, in a safe certificate of deposit. Now, you only get a couple percent nowadays. Let's say you get 10% to make it easy. So then there's foregone interest income. Okay? He would have gotten $10,000 had he left that in a certificate of deposit, let's say, at a bank. So we add up what's called, it's sometimes called implicit costs, or it's sometimes called the opportunity costs. We add that up, that's $65,000. $65,000. Okay. That's part of the total costs. You have, in the economist's in the economist's accounting, total costs are $165,000. This guy only earned revenues of $120,000, meaning that he lost $45,000. And by the way, let me make this make this 140. That's what I meant to do. So, you know, the accountant thinks he earned $40,000, and if this is then 140, yeah, okay. So I want so the loss is $25,000. So the economist would say, no, there's no pure there's no net earnings of $40,000. In fact, there is a pure loss, okay, of $25,000. Now, why is that? Does that make sense? Well, think about it. If he never started that firm, how much money would he have at the end of the year? He'd have his $100,000 safe in a certificate of deposit. He'd have $50,000 in wages, $5,000 for the rent from the truck, and he'd have the interest interest from the invested money of $10,000. He would have, to break even, he has to earn $165,000. So let's say he did earn $165,000. We would then say in economics, he has not earned any pure profit. There's no return to his entrepreneurial function. All of his return, all of the income is a return to the resources he owned, to his labor. The $50,000 is returned to his labor. The $5,000 is to his ownership of this capital good. The $10,000 is to the interest on the money capital. Now, why is that important? It's important so that you understand that pure entrepreneurial profit does not come from owning anything, okay, though you have to own these things to be an entrepreneur. It comes from what? Making the right decision about how to use what you own. That's the key point. So if his revenue was $200,000, then he would have had a pure profit of what? $35,000. Now, where does profit come from? Where does loss come from? Okay, and remember, the entrepreneurial system in the U.S. is not a profit system. It's a profit and loss system. Because you can always make mistakes. All right, the ultimate source of profit and loss is uncertainty. And let me explain what I mean here. Let's say I hold up this $20 bill. I'm going to auction it off, okay? And, you know, even though I'm Italian and I'm from New Jersey, you trust that it's not counterfeit, so you trust it's real, okay? So what happens? And let's assume I'm going to deliver this to you in 1 year, okay? I put it, Lou Rockwell's very trustworthy. I put it in Lou Rockwell's possession with instructions that he turn it over to the person who bids the highest for it. So you are absolutely certain of what you're getting. You're getting this $20 bill 1 year from now. How much would the bidding end up at? Close to $20, but leaving room for interest. That is, because you could make the $20 if you took, whatever the interest rate, $19.50, put it in a bank. So it's going to be somewhere around $19.50, something like that. Okay? Now, if this is really a $10 bill, and let's now introduce uncertainty, you can't really see what it is. Some people think it's 10, some people think it's a $50 bill, okay? But it's really a $20 bill, okay? Well, let's say, first of all, everybody's confused and they think it's a $10 bill. But someone else who has better sight, meaning better foresight into the future, says, you know what, that's a $20 bill. And they bid $11. They bid it away from everybody else. They make a pure profit, okay? On the other hand, let's say everybody confuses this for a $50 bill, except for a few people who say, you know what, that's a 20. I'm not going to bid on that. So the price is going to be $50. The key is this. If, take a world where there's perfect certainty, the first, where everyone knows it's $20, okay? What would be the price of all the inputs in the economy? They would be so high that would there be any room for profit left? No. All that anybody wanted to invest, in other words, if all the entrepreneurs knew exactly what the prices of all different goods in the U.S. economy was going to be 1 year from now, or however long it takes to produce that good, they would all bid the input prices up to what point? Up to the point of the price, minus the margin for the interest rate. So everybody would just earn interest, no profit. There is no profit where there is no uncertainty. Okay? Now, where there is uncertainty, then some resources are being used the wrong way. Some are being used in low-valued uses. Others are being used in uses that are overvalued. Okay. So let me give you an example of this. A couple examples. Let's take movies first. Remember the Blair Witch Project? Okay, that was made for $60,000. Okay. And then it was there was another $1 million in advertising put in or so, but the people who originally made the movie, it was $60,000 to them. That movie returned $40 million. Was there a pure profit there? Sure there was. Why? Because the people who made that movie saw that this little twist, making it almost like a documentary, and with the shaky cameras and everything, and the cool ending, all that stuff. They could buy film, cameras, and unknown actors who people were only willing to pay how much for? Other entrepreneurs only saw that as worth about $60,000. That's why they were able to bid the $60,000 and then turn it into a product that was worth how much to consumers? $40 million. Same thing with Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ. I saw him interviewed. He said it cost about $50 million to make. About $40 million to work, make. And worldwide, at this point, it's $500 million it's returned. Okay? So once again, this was open to any entrepreneur to do something like this. But Mel Gibson took all the inputs, which were worth in total, were being used in other parts of the movie industry, and were worth only $40 million. Okay? No other entrepreneur would bid higher than him for them. He got them, and then he transformed them, because that's what production is, into a product that was worth $500 million to consumers. That's how the entrepreneur earns profit, by using existing resources that anybody can buy better than other entrepreneurs, by seeing better into the future and adjusting production. Seeing better is not enough. People could have a lot of good ideas. The guy who drew Superman for the first time, in the 1930s, he invented the character. The left-wingers will say, oh, then a big company came along and bought the character. Well, the whole point was, someone saw that character could be the basis in fiction, first in comic books, then TV shows and movies, of a lot of value to consumers. So he actually sold it for like $500 in the mid-1930s, the rights to that character. Okay, and it's generated for whomever has it. I don't know if it was resold or not, but it's generated hundreds of millions of dollars, no doubt. Okay. There's a very good example of this This was in Forbes. This is back in 1993, but it shows you very starkly that the key thing is the difference between the price and the average cost. Okay, so the price is simply the total revenue divided by the number of units. Okay, that's your price. Okay, so if you sell 10 candy bars for a dollar each, it's $10. You divide the $10, the total revenue, by to get back to the price. You divide it by the 10 candy bars you sold, you got the dollar. The average cost is simply the total cost divided by the number of units. So if the candy bars cost you $5 to produce and divide by 10, then the average cost is 50 cents. Okay. And then the profit per unit is the profit over Q. Okay. So if this difference is positive, it means that the entrepreneur has taken resources that had a lower value and is using them to better satisfy consumers. Okay. If it's negative, like with mainframe computers, as I said, IBM lost $13 billion in 1992 and 1993 together. They may have cost them $3 million to produce a mainframe, but they may only been able to sell it for $2 million because they made a mistake regarding what the market would be like for mainframes, and so then they would lose $1 million. Now people tend to feel sorry for firms that lose money, but they're wasting resources. They use labor material resources that could have been used elsewhere in high tech industries and been worth $3 million, but they bid higher and they got it for $3 million, and they then used it in a wasteful way. Okay, now let me just give you a simple example. In 1989, there was a woman named Tomima Edmark, and she worked for IBM in Dallas. She was a mainframe saleswoman, and one morning she woke up and found out that her blonde ponytail looked a little drab. Okay, but she found that she could braid the ponytail by using a makeshift device. It was really just a plastic loop and a knitting needle. Okay, so she started to think, well, I wonder if other women could quickly, you know, fix their hair like this if I sort of put together a product that was. So she looked on the market. There was no products like this, and she was then 32 years old. So she put down $5,000 for a patent for this very simple product using very cheap inputs. Okay, who no one else saw the potential use for in this area. And she called it Topsy Tail. I don't know if they still sell them. Anyway, she went on to a number of companies who she asked to, you know, produce it for her. They turned her down flat. So then what she began to do, she decided to market the gadget on her own. She bought a mold for $9,000 in the savings that she had. So she took this big risk, you know, that was her whole life savings, hadn't saved much. And she made them for about 50 cents a piece, okay? And then she started advertising in small hairstyle magazines, like Hairdo Ideas. Okay, so she bought an ad for $1,000 in 1991, she bought this ad, and then she got orders worth about $1,000. And she filled them herself, okay? She actually stuffed envelopes at night after work, okay? By the end of 1991, she was moving 200 units a month at $10 each, okay? So now she's up to making $2,000 a month, okay? She's selling for $10 each, and she's making them for less than a dollar each, okay? Then she was in New York on IBM Business. She ran into the Glamour magazine editor, and she showed her this product. And they featured it in the February 1992 issue. Within 3 weeks, she had $100,000 worth of orders. Okay? For basically what is a knitting needle and a plastic hoop. And she hired a cleaning lady to help her stuff 400 envelopes each week. So she's doing this on her own still. Now IBM, which was having problems, as I mentioned, about this time, bought her out and gave her like $25,000 for early retirement. And she lived off that money while she was going around trying to promote this product. And the sales dramatically increased whenever women saw how easy the plastic device was to use. So guess what? What's the next step? People just have to see it demonstrated. You go on TV, which is what she thought of and what she did. and she found this small company in New Jersey, a small TV commercial company that makes TV commercials. They make these late night commercials for sunglasses and various kitchen gadgets. Anyway, she appeared in a commercial herself, and demonstrated it. And she cut the price because she figured she'd get a lot of big volume. So she sold them for $1 a piece. $1 a piece. That's wrong. Okay, on her own, she had sold 250,000 at $10 a piece in 20 months. Now, when she went on TV in December 1992, she sold 3.6 million at $15 a piece. So that was what? Yeah. Well, because the demand increased. If you show more people, there's an increase in demand. So she sold 5,000 at $15 each in the first 11 minutes of being on QVC. Okay. So of course now there's a lot, she had a lot of people sort of copying her, but, so she's a multimillionaire now. Okay. And, she's down to, the cost was only 22 cents at the end. She was, she began selling for $5. The cost had gone down to 22 cents. And, so that's what an entrepreneur does. An entrepreneur does something that no one else has thought of, uses resources in a way that anyone could use them, but no one has the same idea as the entrepreneur. Now, how else can we earn profit? Okay, so in her case, $15.50 here. Okay, she was earning huge profits. Does that mean she was ripping off consumers? No, quite the contrary. The social function of profit is to do what? Social function of profit is to move resources from areas where they have very low values into areas where consumers value them more. Now, was she able to keep the price up? No, because she had all these copycats very quickly. So what happens when you have the copycats? Copycats come in, and they begin to produce the product. The supply of the product increases. Okay. Now, patents are a government monopoly. So some of our profits are due to these patents, which is sort of a government monopoly. But you can change the product a little bit so it avoids violating the patent. So let's say at the end, this is $1. Okay, because they bid for these resources. They bid the prices up. And there's a tendency for profits to disappear. So many people will come in that they drive the pure profit down to zero. Does that mean she stops making these things? No, because she's still getting a return on her capital, the normal return on her capital, and any resources that she puts in on her labor and so on. So there's no pure entrepreneurial profit. Okay, prices always tend to fall. So when the first light beer came in, Miller Lite, in the mid-1970s, they were charging, I remember, much higher, like $6 a six, whatever it was, much higher than, I think Bud at the time was $2.50. But what happened? Bud Light came in, then Michelob Light came in, and then what happened to the prices of these light beers? They dropped. Okay? So even though uncertainty causes new profits to continue, opportunities to continually arise, at the same time, other entrepreneurs move into the market where there's profit and drive the prices down. So profits have a continual tendency to disappear. But why do they keep appearing, reappearing? Because people's tastes are always changing. New technology's coming in. Another way to earn profits is to cut your costs. Okay. So if you come in, the first hand calculator was $350, introduced in 69 or 70 by, I think, Texas Instruments. And let's say cost was $100. Pretty quickly we had other companies competing, and that drove the price down to 100. Okay, so the profits disappeared, or tended to disappear. But of course, we had the microchip revolution. Okay, where you could make transistors that are very, very tiny. And what happened to the cost of hand calculators? Well, the first company that would come in with this could cut the price to, let's say, $90, but their costs were only 50. Because they were using this better technology. Then others would copy that, and eventually we get what we have today, where you get hand calculators, for $5. Okay. There's probably not any more pure profit in the hand calculator industry. Okay. All of them squeezed out by price competition. Which brings me to another interesting article I want to just bring to your attention about the ballpoint pen. Does anyone know when the ballpoint pen came into existence? Yeah, that's right, exactly. You're right. October 1945, something called the Reynolds International Pen Company began to produce the pen, and Gimbel's, which used to be the big competitor of Macy's in New York City, right across the street from one another, introduced it. And the cost of production was 80 cents, and they sold it for $12.50. Okay, because what was the alternative? The alternative was the fountain pens, which are kind of messy and so on. And so people were willing to pay a high price for this. Now, that's $12.50 in 1945 dollars. That's over $100 in today's dollars. So the ballpoint pen was sort of like having a Mercedes in your driveway. You know, you'd leave ballpoint pens out on your coffee table and people came over to show how well off you are. You know, this is like a very expensive item. What happened was, and then competition came in. By early 1946, Reynolds had expanded. They were producing more. Macy's then introduced the ballpoint pen at $19.98. Then Eversharp introduced its first model at $15. And then a Schieffer pen introduced one at $12.50. By then, costs had fallen to 60 cents. So they were all still making huge profits. Okay. Then they had those heavy sales and so on. Then the Ballpoint Pen Company of Hollywood introduced the first ballpoint pen less than $10 at $9.95. Okay. Reynolds came back and cut the price to $3.85. But by then they had cut the cost of production to 30 cents per unit. So still huge profits. Okay. But you see what's happening. Prices are moving down. Costs are moving down. By December, approximately 100 manufacturers, a year later, December 94, 100 manufacturers were producing ballpoint pens and were selling them for as little as $2.98. A few months later, Gimbel's began selling a pen that was priced at 98 cents. So within 2 years, the price comes down from what, you know, $20 or whatever it was to 98 cents. However, other pens began to be sold at 39 cents, but then the cost was driven down to 10 cents. All right. So you get the idea. What happens is that even if you are an entrepreneur that has a good idea and you're earning a lot of money initially, what happens? Emulators come in. Other people emulate you. Competition increases the supply, drives up your costs, and then prices and costs come together. Okay? Now, could it ever be the case that all profits and losses would disappear in the economy? Only if an angel came down and said nothing will ever change again. If nothing ever changed again, people's tastes didn't change, there was no improvement in technology, and resources remained the same, that is people's skills and the amount of coal and so on. If all those things happened, eventually what would happen to all profits and losses? They'd all be wiped out. Now, why are losses wiped out? Well, the U.S. auto industry lost a lot of money in the 1980s, as I mentioned, because they didn't downsize their cars to take account of the higher gasoline prices. Sort of like IBM, they said Americans will always buy big cars no matter what the price of gasoline is. We're going to continue to make large cars. But the price of gasoline jumped high in the 70s. Japanese came in and said, you know what, we've always had high gas prices. It was $2.50 per gallon for the Japanese back then. And they began exporting, tailoring their cars to the American market and exporting them to the American market. And Americans shifted. So the big three lost billions of dollars in the early 80s. What happened? You saw them slowly shifting out of production of large cars and into the production of intermediate and compact and subcompact cars. So they imitated the Japanese, and that drove the prices of the Japanese cars down. Okay, for a while you couldn't get you had to wait months and months to get Japanese cars. Okay, the demand was so big for them. Okay, all right. So that's the tendency of profits to disappear. One last point I want to make very quickly is. Profits, see, people say that profits are abnormally high. Okay? Well, I don't mind profits, but, you know, these profits are just abnormally high. They're ridiculous. The oil companies are making much too high profits. Look at the price of gas. The point is that profits are never normal. Some people have in their mind that profits should be normal. Okay? Profits are never normal. Why? Because what profits are result from is a maladjustment. What's the maladjustment between? What two things? What people want, okay, or will want in the future, and what is being produced by current entrepreneurs today. That's the maladjustment. If you earn a profit, if you produce a topsy tail, it means that there weren't enough of these things being produced. Or maybe there weren't any of them being produced. Or if you introduce a hand calculator, it means, again, there weren't enough being produced. Okay? So once there's enough being produced, the once you see, you shouldn't blame the firm at the high profits. The firm at the high profits is the first firm to begin to correct the maladjustment. It's the firms that come in later on that are slower. If all firms came in at the same time, they all saw at the same time, would there be any profits? No. Production would immediately adjust. Okay? So don't blame the firms with the high profits. It's like, if you have a quick example here, let's say you have a sort of an isolated area, let's say at the Appalachian Mountains in West Virginia and Kentucky, where people, don't have much access to medical care. So this is the area here, and there's some Dr. A, Dr. B, Dr. C, Dr. D. They're on the periphery of the area, and sometimes these people come to them. And so let's say Dr. A notices that people have symptoms of a disease that might be an epidemic. So he rushes in, because he believes it's going to break out in 2 weeks. He rushes and sets up a clinic here, right in the middle. People, there are huge lines, and he charges very high prices. Okay? Do you blame him for ripping off the people here? Or is he the first one to increase the supply of medical services where they're most needed? If you blame him, you're blaming the person that's what? Correcting the maladjustment. If everybody, then as everybody else comes in, what happens? Supply increases. And the price does what? Goes down. But if B, C, and D all were had as much foresight as him and rushed into the area, would there be high prices initially? No. So what he does is he signals, there's a signal here, these high profits send a signal out to the other guys to come in. Okay? So it's like blaming the first doctor on the scene, right? To blame the company that has the high profits.
But of course, the reality is,
but yeah, but let's say this is the 1950s, before all that nonsense came in. Okay, and you would see that type of thing. Okay. Last but not least, I guess I'll just say this. Just because you're very successful in the past, as IBM was in the 70s and 60s, as U.S. auto companies were in the United States in the 50s and 60s, everyone thought they were monopolies and no one could challenge them. Yet they made mistakes in anticipating consumer demand. And what happened? IBM became a small player. I mean, no one could have thought that would have happened in the 70s. And GM was on the verge of being taken over last year. Right? Okay, and you think about these things and you see that no matter how small somebody is, if they have a good idea and have some capital to back them, they can compete with the bigger firms. Right? So I will stop here and take, one question. You had your hand first. Underlying stocks.
How does that match what we learned yesterday with the whole issue about imputation, that the value is really coming from the
consumers.
Buyer of the stock and not from the...
Okay, I understand. Okay, let me answer that real quick. The value doesn't come from the buyer of the stock, ultimately. It comes from consumers in the future who you expect to buy the products, the output from the machinery and capital. Then the capital goods have a total value. All a firm is the capital goods. And then the value of the stock, a stock is simply a share of ownership in these capital goods. So there's expectations on the part of the people who buy the stocks, but ultimately who controls the value? It's always the consumers. Okay? Okay, I'll stop here. Thank you.